Hello and thank you for joining us for this week's edition of The Front Page. I'm your host, Racing Post editor Tom Kerr, and my oh my, do we have a packed show for you this week. Even by the standards of recent times, the last 7 days has been incredibly turbulent. But welcome was a rare outbreak of common sense. 7 days ago exactly, we got the news nobody was expecting that the Cheltenham Festival would be staying at 4 days and not adding a controversial fifth. A couple of days later, the racing's leadership finally acted on uncompetitive field sizes, axing 170 races from the summer programme, among a raft of other changes. We then lost another Prime Minister, Liz Truss finally bowing to the inevitable and leaving office, but not before heaping another dollop of uncertainty onto all of our plates. Discussing all of this and much more, including the return of Cheltenham this weekend, is John Harding. Welcome, John. And joining us remotely is Maddie Playle. Hello, Maddie.
Hi, Tom.
So, John, we're coming to you first this week. What's your story?
Yeah, so you may have noticed over the weekend there was outrage, I think is fair to say, over the price of a pint of Guinness and a paper cup at Cheltenham, which was the sort of beginning of a wider debate on the value of going racing. And I'm going to dub it Guinnessgate for the purposes of this conversation. Excellent. So it began with pictures of this slightly dodgy looking pint and people saying, well,
looked like a cappuccino kind of.
It looks pretty poor, yeah. But it's part of an eco drive from them, so I'm not going to. We'll forget the vessel, but it's more the cost of the pint and how that compares to other sports and how racing generally offers value to its customers. Now, race courses, as we know, are walking quite a delicate tightrope during the cost of living crisis. Attendances are down, which is hugely concerning for everybody. Mm-hmm. And they've got their own finances, their own costs to look after. And naturally, with inflation, they're going to have to charge a little bit more to cover their side of things. But it's a question of how much of that cost is then passed on to the customer. And if you get that balance wrong, as people are suggesting they have with a £7.50 pint, then people are going to stop going, aren't they? Because it costs money to get in. You're then paying £7.50 a pint. The food is questionable at times, I think, is fair to say. So, yeah, it's just this broad. I think it's a debate that's going to roll on because we're talking about the value. I don't think people mind spending money on things at the moment. And I think racing in terms of entry costs and in terms of the cost of things in there is not a million miles off. You know, if you went to a Premier League football game, you're paying £7.50, £7 a pint in London. You know, tickets to get into these things, £80, £90. It's about right. But it's about what the situation is once you're in the venue, and whether racing, that whole experience, offers value, I think, is the story here.
Yeah, I think a £7.50 pint is obviously eye-catching, but it's emblematic of a much broader debate about the cost of everything, and specifically for racing, the cost of going racing. Let's just put in context, though, this pint of Guinness. So it was £7.50. It was £7 at Cheltenham during the festival when people were remarking then about how incredibly expensive it was. They fairly say inflation is driving this. I think it's worth noting, though, that at Sandown, which is also run by the Jockey Club and is obviously very close to central London, they were charging £6.80 in May when they last raced. So I would question whether the rate of inflation in the Gloucestershire region is justifying that sort of discrepancy. But clearly, you know, everything's expensive now and you're probably looking at paying north of £7 when you go to any sort of major sporting event. And on that, I just pulled some entry costs before we came in here. You can go to Cheltenham November meeting for £32 in tats, which you know, I think compares pretty favourably with Premier League football, for example. The Daily Mirror last year found that the average cheapest ticket at the Premier League was £30. So basically, you can get into tats for the same price as what's probably going to be an absolutely dreadful ticket at one of the Premier League grounds. So, you know, racing probably offers quite good value, I would say. But once you get in there, you know, and bearing in mind, you're also going, and most people are having a bet, and if you don't have a successful day, then it can turn into a really expensive outing.
No, and that's the key point, I think. Racing's positioned itself quite favourably in what is now an increasingly competitive market with other sports, given the pressure on people's disposable income. So actually getting people in, ticket prices, under-18s going free, check, great news. You know, different tiers of tickets catering to, they talk about where the pinch points are. Hospitality does reasonably well, but the general tickets is where they've seen a sort of dip in terms of attendances, so they're freezing prices. Chester and Arena Racing Company making sure that remains affordable for sort of the average race goer.
Yeah, let's just remind us about that, because ARC and Chester have announced over the last week a very welcome response to the sort of cost of living crisis.
Yeah, so they've sort of set their prices at what I would call a sensible kind of point, haven't they? And it's their costs have gone up, and the temptation might have been to rise that or to have that increase with inflation. But to just keep it, particularly that bottom end, I think is very important.
Yeah. Maddie, what do you think about the cost of going racing? Is it good value? And what can the sport do during this cost of living crisis to try and ensure that going racing is affordable to the average person and attractive?
Yeah, at the very top end, you know, it's not going to be affordable for everyone. Those luxury hospitality packages. I was looking just the other day at Derby Day, for instance. If you're to have a 5 to 17-year-old child in the Queen Elizabeth II stand, it'll put you back £100 and £125 to have reserved seating. So that's certainly not accessible for everyone. But then on the other hand, a couple of weeks ago, months back even, I tweeted about how you could buy a Best Mate ticket to the Showcase November and international meetings for a tenner. Now, I appreciate not everyone wants the view that the Best Mate enclosure can provide, but you're getting however many races, top class at the home of jumps racing for a tenner. And I think that's pretty good value. And you have to give credit where it's due. Myself and Jonathan's topics are sort of going to overlap here in terms of what can be done. I think there's two ways to go at it. And I'll speak more about these in a moment. But essentially, it's about making racing, as that dreaded word, as a product, stronger. And making the experience of a higher quality. And those are things that I definitely think there's work to do on both scales.
John, the other week we had a really interesting interview with Barry Hearn, the legendary sports promoter. And one of the things he said was basically, you know, during this sort of cost of living crisis, you need to hang on to your customers. You need to treat them with the utmost respect and do everything possible to hang on to them, because it's going to be a really tough 18 months. You know, do you think racing is doing that?
No, would be the evidence from the weekend. And it's okay to say, well, we've got our own costs and we're putting prices up because of inflation, but there's always headwinds. And it's not fair for that to be passed on to the customer base just as standard. Okay, well, our costs are going up. Here's a £7.50 pint of Guinness. It's immensely frustrating. And I think jumps racing generally, having done stories on attendances right the way through the year, jump racing has a loyal following, more so than the flat. It was a sign that perhaps it would be easier going into the winter in terms of attendances. But if you're treating your loyal customers poorly, then why would they? And I think this is the absolute crux of the issue, is we're making racing accessible to get in, but then it's almost like our job's done for some racecourses. And look, I'm not singling out Cheltenham or any racecourse in particular, but it can't be a case of we're getting people in, great, leave them to it, they'll look after themselves, they'll keep coming back. That experience has to be interesting. It has to be kind of innovative, to use a press release word. But we need something. You know, what people don't want is just, okay, maybe we get in a family at a reasonable price, the ticket's fine, and the racing's okay, no problem. But then to have sort of bland food and expensive pints, people are going to question the value for money there, aren't they? It has to. There's so much room for change on this front. And a few people online have been suggesting, can we get local producers in to offer something that's not bland and greasy? Can we get... There's room here to improve that experience. A lot of racecourses get it right. You know, Ascot famously experiences something that they pride themselves on, York as well. But I think mustn't get complacent, because it's one thing to get people in and it's another thing to keep them coming back.
Well, there we go. 750 pints of Guinness, fair price or gouging the customer? Tell us in the comments. Go on to our second topic now, and Maddie, I'm going to bring you in here. You're going to talk more about the return of Cheltenham, which means the jump season has begun in earnest.
It has, yeah, and a few strands of thinking here. Obviously, we know that the Cheltenham Festival is now going to stick to 4 days, which was a very welcome announcement last week. I think we're all really chuffed that we're not going to get a further dilution of ratings products. But what happens next? Well, it's not off the table that we will have a five-day festival in future. And I think that there is a degree of inevitability behind that. What else can Cheltenham do to be better? I've been thinking a little about that in the last couple of days. And as I said previously, it's about either treating the problem at the core, that be via the fixture list and clamouring for a whole-scale reworking of that, but also focusing on British racing so it can compete with our Irish counterparts. We saw at Cheltenham this week, seven British, seven Irish. And I think it's a cyclical problem, isn't it? If we sort out our fixture list, if we inject some prize money into our races, then we're going to attract and retain more owners and hopefully be able to better compete, particularly if we bolster our bloodstock. If you look at most of the leading sires in the National Hunt game, they're mostly standing in Ireland. So that's one issue. You're treating it at the core. But the other is also the experience, the affordability, the facilities. Our colleague Andrew Dietz sort of spoke about a few of these issues. And I guess, speaking anecdotally as well, if I just use some of my own experiences, but first, Cheltenham, 280,000 people went to the Cheltenham Festival in 2022. They're going to cap it at 274,000 people per day in 2023. I wonder if that's going to be significant enough to ease pressure on their facilities. They said that those facilities were under pressure a few days at this year's festival. Indeed, when I went on Wednesday, when you'll remember, there was that downpour. There was a real pressure. It was hard to get a drink. It was hard to even find somewhere dry to stand. Getting in and out, the operations of the event, I think, could be improved. There was issues with parking, with taxis, with traffic control. And that's something that I've heard again from the showcase meeting. There were issues there. And another thing, Jonathan sort of touched upon it already, is the food and drink at race courses. I think in Cheltenham's case, that could probably be improved. And a question raised by one person on social media was, should you be allowed to bring your own food? Now, I don't really know the answer to that question, because some sporting events you're allowed, some sporting events you aren't allowed. But certainly it's a question that's worth asking when we are under such pressure in this time of cost of living. And we need better variety and quality, I think, if we're to rival the very best sporting events. And just to heap some more negative energy on this, if you like, I know, Tom, you were tweeting about the hotels around Cheltenham. I mean, there's nothing they can do about that, but sort of £800 a night to stay during the festival is certainly going to put a lot of people out of calculations. So I think there's definitely work to be done here in terms of the experience. I think Jonathan said about innovation. I'd love to see Cheltenham embrace the simple things, even just by offering more seating and things like that, but also embrace technology. It's not a like-for-like comparison, I know, but if you go racing in Hong Kong, there's big screens with iPads where you can view the form and really go in depth on each horse, and nice graphics. And it's just more of an immersive, innovative experience. I'd love to see Cheltenham really step into the digital age a bit more as well. So, four-day festival, it's great that it's not going beyond that, but I think there's potential there to make this even better than it currently is.
Yeah, fantastic. There's so many talking points coming out of Cheltenham this week, Maddie. Let's go back to one of the first ones you mentioned, which is about competitiveness. I guess two interesting things happened last week to affect that. The first was the BHA and racing's leaders announcing these changes to the fixture list, cutting 170 races out of the summer programme and redistributing some of them to periods of the calendar that are under less pressure. But then at the weekend, we saw once again some of the sort of issues that have bedeviled British jumps racing. We of course, did have seven Irish winners. We also had a race without a single British runner in it. And we had Paul Nichols, the most successful trainer at the meeting, who had only one runner, obviously a winner. But nonetheless, you know, is this a sort of an ominous sign for British racing, or are we starting to turn the corner with these changes announced this week, Maddie?
Time will tell with the changes. Firstly, it's a little misleading to say the races have been cut, as you say, because in truth, many of them have just been redistributed. And really, I think that's going to have a minimal impact. We'll have to measure it when they come around. Movements like the no wait for age novice chases between May and August and the changings to the reduction of conditions races, I think, are undoubtedly a good move. And we should credit that it's promising that we've had this development when we didn't think that we'd get key changes to the fixture list until 2024. But I think anyone expecting this to make a huge difference is probably going to end up surprised. In terms of the Irish dominance, look, we know that Ireland have the strength and depth in their horses at the moment. And that's going to be reflected, especially when they're bringing them over and targeting this showcase meeting, which the likes of John McConnell did. I wouldn't necessarily, this meeting in particular is going to be representative of what's going to happen for the rest of the season. I think John McConnell indeed and some of the British trainers reacted to this in a piece on the website recently. But in terms of ground, when trainers were coming to declarations, it was good ground. And although that changed and perhaps some of them might not have foreseen that happening, they weren't wanting to start their winter horses off on better ground, which is what they thought it would be at the time. Whereas some of the other horses, you look at Dad's Lad, who won at Cheltenham, you know, he's been busy. Efanok Fizz has been scooping good prizes, the Welsh champion hurdle in this country. I think 7-7 obviously looks alarming, but in this case, if we compare it to previous years as well, it is a standout. You know, they won 3 of the 14 races in 2021, 2 in 2020, 1 in 2019, and 4 in 2018. But I think it's a two-pronged sword in that the Irish are happy to take these chances when they know they have strong horses in that category and these races will suit them. But also, I think the British are probably not sent all their big guns out for this meeting, as sometimes can be the case, whether that be just because we've had quite a dry autumn and they're not quite as forward as they would be, or just because they're wanting to save their bullets for later on in the season. I would be wary of going crazy and saying this is a whole-scale disaster for British racing just because there's been the winners shared equally. It's not a good sign, but realistically, we know that the Irish are strong. And they have a lot of the better horses, so they're going to be winning these better races.
John, another interesting angle that came out of Cheltenham was the crowds. Mm-hmm. Very much a tale of two meetings here. The Friday was down 29% on 2019 and was the lowest for an October race day at the track in 22 years. Pretty sobering.
Yes.
The Saturday, however, was a record attendance. Albeit 25% of the crowd were students who were basically bused there as part of an organisation with the slightly ominous name Invades, but they bused them there from 8 universities in the area. You know, that's a difference between the Saturday crowd being absolutely abysmal, mm-hmm. and being record breaking. So you know. Kind of a worrying picture, but then you've got this quite encouraging aspect of young people being encouraged to get involved and have a day at the races.
Yeah, I mean, starting with the drop on the Friday, like I say, we've been looking at the attendances on an almost month by month basis. I'm not surprised to hear 29% drop. I'm not surprised to hear lowest in however many years. That has been the trend this year, and it's hugely alarming. Saturday perhaps offers a glimpse into one of the potential fixes for this, which is, you know, I'm sure Maddie's the same, constantly being asked, how do we get the next generation of people to go racing? How do we get them interested? And this seems to me like a very good idea. 5,000 people through the gate. I understand there might be a little bit of reticence by your sort of hardcore race goer who says that we don't want them there, we don't want people there drinking, we don't want people going for the wrong reasons, but actually beggars can't be choosers.
And it's how people get into racing as well.
It's how people get into racing.
We can't be so. You have a bet, you have a pint, and you have a great time, and then some of them will come back again and they'll start learning more about the sport and appreciating it on a different level to this purely social.
Yeah, we can't be so naive as to think that, you know, everybody's coming in and they study the form and they go watch the horses in the paddock and they clap quietly when the horses come in. That's not the case. Just like at football matches, you're going to have people who prefer to sit quietly and have a read of the programme. You're going to have people who go for 10 pints before in the pub. This is what happens. Racing is fairly universal. It can offer things for different people in a way other sports perhaps can't. And somebody has decided to tap into that and brought 5,000 people to, I believe, the Best Mate enclosure. So slightly siloed in that sense anyway.
I think it's almost perfect in that respect, isn't it?
Perfect track for it to
happen. They can have a great time there and they're not bothering the people who might, you know, take scans to having 5,000 students tramping around.
I'd love to know how many of those 5,000 thought, do you know what, this is actually great and I really liked the racing and perhaps I'll come back for another meeting.
Well, this student organisation, Invades, have been going for some time and they do a lot of this. So clearly they've got some repeat custom because otherwise it wouldn't be a going concern. Maddie, students coming racing, got to be good news, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we've touched on it there, but I don't think we can be fussy when it comes to getting people in the doors, you know, and these are young people who, if they have a positive experience and if they think it's for them, then they could become devoted sort of lifelong fans of the sport. I think the difficult part of the equation, if you like, is helping them make that transition. There's nothing wrong with people going for a social day out at the races. At least in my mind, there shouldn't be anyway. It's a great experience. But also there is potential there to really sell our sport and showcase what it's about and share our passion for it. And I think it's being able to get that across that is the tough bit.
Okay, John, final story. I'm going to tell you about an investigation we had in the newspaper yesterday. Senior writer Lee Mottershead looking at the RSPCA, the almost two-century-old charity. They, in late September, got together with two other animal charities and issued a call for the abolition of greyhound racing. They were citing welfare issues in the sport, and the campaign announcement basically claimed that this was a culmination of mounting frustration and exasperation at greyhound racing failing to make progress on welfare issues. Greyhound racing was stunned by this and responded very robustly. They pointed out they'd only months earlier rolled out a new welfare strategy drawn up by veterinarian, and they were quite staggered by both the call for the ban, but also the suggestion that they weren't doing anything on welfare. We got Lee to look into this because obviously greyhound racing is an animal sport, and it's got its own unique issues. It's not comparable to racing in every respect, but there are obvious similarities. Fundamentally, they are two sports that involve racing animals. So Lee looked into this and sort of was questioning, you know, what are the motivations behind it? Why is the RSPCA now turning against greyhound racing? And ultimately, does racing have something to fear? One of the people he spoke to was the chair of the GBGB, which is the BHA of greyhound racing, if you like, who ironically is a former RSPCA chief executive. And he was very, very clear that this is the thin end of the wedge. And if they take out greyhound racing, they will come for racing. And he said, we've gone back to the RSPCA being run by extremists, animal rights extremists. The RSPCA obviously refute this. They claim this is not the case. And they say there's clear differences between greyhound racing and racing. What's your take on it? Does racing have cause to fear that this is a direction of travel that logically takes RSPCA eventually into being opposition to racing?
I think absolutely it is a huge red flag, and racing would do well to pay attention to what's happening to greyhound racing, and you don't want to get to a situation where it comes and you're not prepared for it. I mean, I've been going on about this for a while. I mean, I was once asked what was the biggest issue facing racing, and I said welfare. And I was met with the usual, well, I've been to 100 yards and I've never seen any poor welfare standards. Well, nobody's saying that. But the crux of this is the perception of welfare. It's not enough to have high welfare standards. You have to prove to other people, even those who aren't willing to be persuaded, that your welfare standards are indisputably, undeniably good and evolving with the times as well. So, yeah, I mean, it is a big red flag. I don't know The RSPCA and racing is a slightly strange relationship. It's been one of collaboration, but there's a sense that maybe that relationship has cooled a touch. I know that RSPCA has spoken about perhaps the BHA not engaging with the charity in the way that it used to.
Which we should know. You know, was greeted off the record by the BHA with no small degree of surprise, because that is not how they would characterise their relationship with the RSPCA. They're very keen, they say, and it appears that they say fairly, they're very keen to engage with the RSPCA and to have a constructive relationship with the charity. But then again, Greyhound Racing thought they had that as well, and that's one of the reasons it was so shocking for them. Maddie, what are your thoughts on this? Does racing have something to fear? And perhaps just as relevant, you know, is there anything racing can actually do to deter the RSPCA sort of drifting away from its previously constructive relationship?
Well, the first question about does racing have anything to be worried about? Well, it's hard to say, isn't it? But the best thing that I think we can do in this circumstance is just focus on what we can control, which is... basically conducting all our movements factually, responsibly, and looking to the future, and just making the right decisions. Jonathan mentions public perception. I often think that when, you know, breaking of rules does occur, it's often about how we respond to that as well. So we need to be as prepared as we can be for if the RSPCA's relationship with racing crumbles like it has done in the greyhound industry. I was at an event last week, a WOTA forum, where Rolly Owers spoke. He's the chief of World Horse Welfare, and that was really interesting. He did a keynote discussion talking about what racing can do in terms of welfare. And I think, as I've said, it's about... showcasing the good work we do, but also really just trying to package it and show it in a way where it's undeniable that not just we have very high standards of welfare, but also the progress that we're making as well, just so that people can have confidence in racing at a time when racing's social license is increasingly becoming questioned.
Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it? You know, the RSPCA, you know, obviously a sort of a pillar of establishment respectability in some respects, and therefore, you know, not an organisation you want turning against animal sports, but equally, they don't make the decisions. You know, ultimately, if it ever came down to racing being seriously questioned about its right to continue, it would be down to the public and through the public politicians to make the determination. And, you know, in that respect, racing probably has the right strategy. It's front foot forward. It's about constantly driving further progress and welfare, but also ensuring that that message gets out to the public, whether it's through things like National Racehorse Week or sort of year-round campaigns about, you know, the horse comes first and so on.
Yeah, it's about being proactive. And what I do find quite unhelpful, and what will become increasingly unhelpful if racing is put under the microscope, is this attitude of, well, we'll never convince them. If they don't like it, they can go and bother someone else. They can go and watch, in terms of the public, you know, if racing's not for you, if you don't like it,
go watch Peppa Pig.
And that's, I understand that, you know, racing doesn't want to concede too much ground unnecessarily. That makes sense. There are some people who simply will never be convinced of the merits, of the virtues of the sport and of its welfare standards. But it would be incredibly naive and I think incredibly destructive to therefore just kind of duck beneath the parapet and say, well, we're just going to carry on doing what we want to do, because that's not the way of the world. People's attitudes to animals are changing in terms of for food, let alone for sport. You know, that we are moving towards kind of different generations have different views of the use of animals.
Mm.
Racing has to be sensitive to that. It has to be proactive, and kind of what I want is for it to draw a clear line in the sand, defend what it does well, and get on the front foot and push what it's going to do even better. I think that's the only position that racing can take at this point. But with, as far as the RSPCA goes, it's sort of a watching brief, but they are slightly straying into campaigning, which I'm not sure is entirely their brief, but it'll be interesting to watch anyway. And like you say, they are sort of a rubber stamp, I feel. They are a respectable institution, and Racing would do well to keep them on side.
Yeah, very well put. Well, we will draw it to a conclusion there, and it remains only for me to determine which of these three stories is going on the front page. I'm certainly not going to pick my story again because it's just an abuse of power. I think it's got to be the return of Cheltenham. Well done, Maddie. You made a great case for it. Huge amount of stuff coming out of the two-day fixture. But above all, you know, I think we're all delighted to see the jump season once again return in earnest. And nothing symbolises that more than that magic racecourse, John.
Absolutely.
OK, we will wrap it up there. Thank you so much for joining us. It only remains for me to try to sell you something, which is a subscription to The Racing Post. If you want to get access to all of our fantastic journalism produced by the likes of John, Maddie, Lee Modishead, Chris Cook, and many, many more, plus everything else a subscription offers, such as replays, form analysis, tools, and lots, lots more, check out the description where you will find details of how to sign up. And also in the description, a link to download our brand new mobile app. Please do download, use it, and let us know what you think. Thanks again for joining us. Thanks to John, and thanks to Maddie. We'll see you next week.